Welcome to BoobTube, where two rather fabulous chicks talk speculative television in the form of sci-fi and fantasy. I'm Shireen Nicole. This is my partner in crime, the lovely
Heather Long.
And we are having a fabulous big old CW edition this week. Bring out your emo haircuts and your man titty, because it's on and popping, people. Let's go over what we're going to be looking at today.
More like fangs dropping.
Fangs, okay, well then it's on and fang dropping up in here. The shows we're talking about this week are Arrow, the premiere of Arrow, and we like it a lot. We like it a lot, a lot.
We like it more than a lot. We like it a whole hell of a lot more than a lot. Just coming there with that.
We're talking Supernatural, an episode called What's Up, Tiger Mommy? Oh, well. Okay, anyway. The Vampire Diaries, episode 2, correct? No, episode 1.
It was the season premiere for season 4.
Beauty and the Beast, and Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. So it's all CW all the time this week, and we are kicking it off with what we like a lot, and that is namely Arrow. Heather, go.
Arrow took my breath away. I think the creators and the writers behind this show must have been paying attention to the Avengers Phase 1 films, as well as what were the key things that worked for Smallville. Because they delivered.
They definitely did.
1,010% did they deliver in that episode. I was already geared up to be someone who's going to like it. Comic book fan here. Love DC Comics. Love Green Arrow. I have read Green Arrow for years. Love his relationship with Black Canary, etc. Loved it when he showed up on Smallville. And, of course, when they announced they were going to make the show and it wasn't a spinoff, I was a little worried. Because, you know, really like Justin Hartley. But I'm like, okay, I'll give it a shot. I'll, you know, see what happens. Sat down to watch it. I'm a safe bet that I was going to have at least a decent enjoyment of it because, again, comic books. Was not expecting to be sitting on the edge of my seat, leaning forward, staring at the screen, going,
Yeah, they open with Oliver Queen's shipwreck, and he does this voiceover of his time on the island. You see Deathstroke's mask, right up front on like a spike. So as a comic book fan, you're already like, oh my fluffy Lord. And then you see his face and he's got the full beard and he's telling you this story that he's been through and he gets rescued. We go to the hospital and as the doctor is going down this list of injuries, you're like, holy hell, he's got burns over what? Like 80% of his body?
He has scar tissue over 20% of his body. He had 12 broken bones that did not set correctly, and among numerous other injuries, which right there in the very beginning, if you're paying attention, you know he was not alone on that island for those 5 years.
No, it sounds like Survivor, but for real.
I think that was a part of it, and I think part of it, you know, later in watching him fight, when you see him fighting, when you see him defending, you know, when he's hooking up with people again, and or when he gets kidnapped and he takes down his own kidnappers. I mean, there was a beautiful tied to the chair scene, beautiful homage to the Black Widow scene in Avengers. And of course, that scene's been done before. It's not like it's a new trope,
right.
But it was still very beautifully done as a bookended scene for that scene in the Avengers.
Two
totally different
good.
Comic book companies, but that's okay. I have no complaints.
We're not talking like junk to you.
I will say, however, my favorite line in the entire episode came down to an exchange between Tommy Merlin. You know, Ollie, because Oliver Queen was a dilettante playboy, you know, bad little nugget boy who did what he liked and hung out with his best friend, Tommy Merlin, who, as we later find out, has roofied girls before, too.
Ew!
Yeah, well, there's that comment from Laurel's dad when he says, have you roofied anyone tonight?
Bastard!
Yeah, so he's got that kind of a sleaze skeeze, but see, Tommy Merlin is who Ollie used to be.
Right, and they do say that there's a really nice setup in the hospital where the doctor says, do not expect him to be the Oliver you lost.
Well, after 5 years of being trapped on that island, even if he hadn't been in Survivor for real, he wouldn't be. But anyway, so back at the house. Oh, and as a side note here, is it me or are the queens living in the Luther Castle from Smallville?
Well, you know, I can't tell.
I'm going to go pull out a Smallville episode because every time they pull up to the house, all I got... I see Lex Luthor, and I'm like, wait a minute, whoa, wrong show. But But back to this exchange. So Tommy Merlin has showed up at the Queen's house to pick Ollie up, and they're going to go out and they're going to have a good time and get reacquainted. And as they're walking out of Oliver, because in this show, Oliver has a sister, which he didn't in the comics.
But... Yes. And by the way, comic book fans, he calls his sister Speedy. Easter egg for you.
Which is no Roy Harper, but that's okay. It's okay. I will allow for the liberties that they have taken because it was so good. But he's walking out and Tommy Merlin goes, dude, have you seen how hot your sister got? And Ollie turns around and looks at Tommy Merlin with this expression like, I will fuck you up. And Tommy goes, because I have not.
Right.
Moving right on. I mean, you see that whole self-preservation thing kick in because that was not a friendly look on Ollie's face.
No, that was the death look. I particularly liked was that they use parkour. Okay, we've seen parkour in a lot of action movies lately. Parkour is the resistance exercise where you climb things and move.
Oh, but that happened?
Yes. Yeah. You guys, you guys really need video to see what Heather just did. But they use parkour to great effect to show you just how physically fit and well-trained Oliver Queen is after these 5 years on this island, that the act of doing has turned him into a warrior. And it's so well done, and he kicks such major ass. And then we get to see the man build his own arrows and lair, and that was a lot of fun in, of course, the requisite abandoned warehouse.
But as a side note, we also got a great scene between he and Katie Cassidy's Dinah Laurel Lance, which is a nice nod to the Black Canary from DC Comics, because that's who Dinah Lance will eventually become, although we don't know if she will in this or not. I mean, that's too early to speculate.
Yeah.
But when Ollie was on that yacht with his dad, he was there with Sarah Lance, Dinah's Laurel's little sister.
Yes.
You know, they were getting it on, so...
And don't say that line. Don't say that line. It's for wish I'd said that. I can see your face. We haven't gotten to wish I said that yet, dude.
No, I'm not going there yet.
Okay, but good.
The line I'm looking at is the point where Laurel is talking to Ollie. And Ollie, obviously, he said, when Tommy asked him, what did you miss these last 5 years?
Uh-huh.
He said, Laurel.
Oh, really? I must have been looking
Laurel
away.
Laurel was his girlfriend, and he was screwing around on her with her sister.
Yes,
and
indeed.
He has this moment with Laurel standing there in the street, and Laurel's looking at him, and she's like, you know what?
Five years
was long enough. No. I'm going to save this line, because we're talking about it, and this is what worked for me.
Okay.
Like, when she looks at him and point blank says, 5 years in hell wasn't long enough for you.
Did she say that?
She did.
Bitch.
She put him to rot in hell. No.
No. No.
It was hard for her to mourn for her sister.
I know that, and I get that, and still, what a horrible, rotten, stinky-ass thing to say, and no wonder I didn't like it. I think CW has a major problem in casting, and I don't call women bitches, but this is a character. This is not a real person. That was a bitchy moment. The problem that I think that CW...
deserved it.
He didn't deserve that. He deserved...
She deserved the ability to say that to him, because this is someone she actually had to grieve for him and for her sister while hating them both.
I got that, and she's perfectly right to feel that way, but to wish 5 years of what he went through on him? I have a problem with that, where people say, my pain is worth more than yours.
Well, yeah, but that's...
And that's a huge... But that's a personal issue that I have, but I think the CW has a major problem with casting the female leads in their male-led shows. I oftentimes just don't like these women in their male-led shows. In their female-led shows, I really will enjoy the women in those. It's a very interesting thing, but I think they have love interest problems. I wasn't a big fan of Lois Lane on Smallville. You can kick me. I'm not a big fan of this character here. She's definitely not my freaking Black Canary. So they better do a whole lot of good writing on this chick.
Time. I think it'll be great. However, back one more time. The best thing about her, though, honestly, the best thing about her, her dad is Harry Dresden.
Her daddy is Harry Dresden, and he is magical.
Even if he's playing the beat-up cop, he's got that whole sort of sarcasm thing going on.
He's so good.
So happy to have him on there. And coming up in just a few episodes.
Yes.
We get the uber sexy, lovely, delicious Captain Jack as a guest star on Arrow.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how long he's going to be on it. I don't know how many episodes he's doing. And this is, of course,
John Barrowman.
John Barrowman, thank you very much. I'm sitting here going, I cannot believe I just went blank on his name.
I do it all the time.
But he's coming onto the show. We're going to see the character of the Huntress. We're going to get Deathstroke. The Terminator is coming. So there's all of these layers. So, I mean, and this was just the premiere episode.
Right, and I have a nugget for you. Because Heather and I were speculating whether or not John Barrowman would be Slade / Deathstroke. And we thought yes. Because he appears on the same episode. Heather told me this. He appears on the same episode. They both make their debut in that episode. And we would hope, because he'd be brilliant as a villain. I got a nugget at the Capclave Sci-Fi Convention this weekend where one of the guests there, I can't say who, whispered in my ear that John Barrowman is not going to be Deathstroke. He knows the character Barrowman is playing. It's fantastic. And that Deathstroke is being played by someone else. And he's seen the casting. He couldn't tell me who. So let's see if my source is correct. We'll be kind of chomping at the bit for that.
All right. Well, it's moving right along here. Let's talk about some supernatural and what's up, Tiger Mommy.
Okay. There was so much to love in this episode. There was just a lot of goodness. I mean, What's Up, Tiger Mommy, as the title tells you a lot. Yes, the boys take Kevin home for a visit. Dean does not want to do this, by the way, because he says to him, well, you know, I'm guessing Crowley has your mom surrounded by demons just waiting for you to show up. And Kevin's like, yeah, dude, that's not really comforting. We're going to have to go check on my mother. So they do. They go and check on the mom, played by a lady, I believe her name is Lauren Tom. She was phenomenal. Tough as nails, funny as hell, just a fantastic casting moment. She stood up to Sam and Dean. She's about, I don't know, about 3 feet tall, especially when standing next to Sam and Dean. These are big guys. And she stood her own. There's a lot of whip-smart dialogue back and forth. There is a demon in her kitchen when we get there. Matter of fact, she is indeed surrounded by demons. Sam and Dean do the whole thing. There's a great scene where Kevin knocks on the door after they've killed the surrounding area demons. Kevin knocks on the door. His mom opens and she's got this, like, lip-trembling, whimpering moment. Oh, my God, my son. And she's so happy. And then Sam and Dean douse her ass in holy water. And she's gaping like a guppy, like, and she still hugs her son anyway. Really good stuff there. What happens is they're tracking the word of God, something that Kevin has hidden in either a bus terminal or a train station. And guess what? It's gone. They talk to security.
Shocker,
right? They talk to security. And they find out that someone has been constantly ripping off that set of lockers. Well, the someone ripping off that set of lockers was a security guard before this security guard, who they find in jail. And in a moment where you swear Dean has channeled, like, I'm going to say, what's his name? GD Batman.
Frank Miller.
Frank Miller. Gosh, what's wrong with us today?
I don't know.
In a moment, right...
It's Monday,
and we've been having
the edition was supposed to be on Friday, but we're doing it on a Monday, so we're going to blame Monday.
Monday's fault. So in a pure Frank Miller's Batman moment, Dean goes crazy on this dude. Like, dude is not willing to give up the info on where this tablet is. So Dean's like, yeah, you don't want to talk. I'm just going to loosen my tie. And then, you know, since it's loose, I might as well take it off. Since I took it off, I might as well wrap it around your freaking neck and strangle you until you tell me what I want to know. With a knife. I'm going to strangle you with a tie and a knife. And of course, this young man, or whatever, reveals everything. And they have to go find the tablet, which went to, guess what? A pawn shop.
Yeah, shocker.
From the pawn shop.
The worst place that it could go.
Pawn shop with a Ferrari parked out front. Yes, indeed. So we know that there's been another transaction. This leads them to an auction led by Plutus, the god of greed. When they say that it is a Plutus auction, Dean goes, come on, is that even a planet anymore? And so at this auction, they are putting together their $2,000 and their bits of money so that they can buy the word of God. And of course, the opening bid is, I think, 2 tons of goblin gold.
No, it's dwarf gold.
Dwarf gold. So yeah, that pocket change is not going to get them there.
I'm pretty sure that, you know, those once upon a time dwarves will be showing up here any day now to get their gold back.
And so Crawley, of course, shows up, and Crawley at one point bets the moon. And when they ask him, does he have the moon to bet? He says, of course. Do you think a guy named Buzz gets to go to the moon without making a deal? So there's a lot to love in this episode. We do have a Castiel sighting back in Purgatory.
I miss my Castiel, but I keep worrying about him.
You have to worry about him, and I'll tell you why. It's a flashback in Purgatory. Dean and Benny are searching Purgatory for Cass. They do some very bad things to get information, which shows you how Dean developed his new interrogation technique. And when they find Cass, he's standing by water looking as crazy as Cass has ever looked. And Dean asks him some questions. And there's a great line in the wish I'd said that I'll save for then. But Dean says, Cass, are you okay? He says, well, you know, that's relative. And Cass basically breaks it down to Dean. Dean says, what happened to you? You got ganked by a monster, right? And that's why you left me alone? And Cass says, no, I ran. And Dean says, what? You ran? And Cass says, yeah, well, I'm being hunted by Leviathan. I wanted to keep them away from you.
Aww.
I know, right? This is one of the most awesomest romances ever.
I love my Castiel. I love Misha Collins. He plays him so very well. I mean, the casting on the show is always really, really stellar.
Yeah, it really is. I do.
I've loved them all over the years.
But the thing I do want you guys to know is that it looks like something very bad happened to Cass, but we don't know what this is yet. Yeah.
Heather has a big fat patty look now. I don't want Cass to be okay. It's bad enough when I thought they killed him off the first time. I mean, making him evil was bad. Killing him off was bad.
Yeah, it's just bad.
That's going to suck.
Well, we just have to hope that Jeremy Carver is still bringing things together. Oh, and for you comic book or Avengers fans out there, there is a Mjolnir sighting. The hammer of Thor is all up in this piece, and Sam wields it, which gives you this whole Thor-type feeling, and he's bashing stuff. And most famously, he bashes this guy that AV Club calls Robert Crumb. I call Stan Lee, but he bashes dude in the head, and dude is also in possession of a frost dragon finger. And most notably, 5/8 of a virgin in a bloody brown paper bag. That's right, folks. 5/8 of this virgin. Okay, so watch this episode. It's pretty good. It is getting back to what we've missed. Although I will say this. There was a time when I could always count on Supernatural to turn left. And what I mean is I would normally know somewhat of what they would do because they would always turn left. So I go, the right turn's here, which means the left turn would be here. What is bothering me a little bit about it now in the past two seasons is that they always turn right. They never surprise me anymore. And I mean the surprise after the surprise. They never do that anymore. It's so straightforward these days. And I'm not pleased with that. For example, I had hoped that there would be some funny business with Sam and his girlfriend, and maybe there will be, but it does appear that she is the veterinarian. Big whoop, so much fun. Let's hope there's something beastly happening there, because otherwise, yeah, I'm not going to enjoy that. Heather is laughing. Heather is laughing her ass off at me right now.
I'm not doing so bad. All right, we're going to move on to Thursday night CW lineup, but I actually want to do this a little backwards, which, you know, frankly, because I could talk all night about the Vampire Diaries, and I do my best to keep my comments to a minimum. You know, I'm going to talk about the high points, the low points, and the big, fat, freaking opportunity I think they missed.
Oh, yes, and we will link to Heather's postmortem so you'll get the full view of her thoughts.
And it doesn't have all of it in there, but then, you know, it has a good chunk of it. But I want to actually talk about Beauty and the Beast for a second.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I want to talk about Beauty and the Beast, because I actually went back and rewatched it. After watching it the first time and not being dramatically impressed by it, I went to watch it a second time, because I'm like, okay, now let's take all our preconceptions. I'm just going to watch it for what it is. Yeah, that still didn't work for me. I tried, I watched it. I found that it was very much a, the first 4 minutes, best part of the entire episode.
Best part of the entire episode. They killed the most interesting character right up front.
That's really kind of sad.
Mm-hmm.
When it debuts, it's 2003. Kristen Crook, she's looking like she's 17. That actress must have made a deal with Crowley because she still looks like she's 17.
She does.
She's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she played Lana Lang on Smallville for many years. And of course, she's working at a bar, you know, going to lock up. And she goes out, her car won't start. So she has to call her mom, who's apparently a doctor. And then we get that bit. And her mom comes out. Her mom is of Asian descent, and which I thought was a good casting choice because
I did.
Chris herself is also of Asian descent.
Yeah, you can see that clearly. Yeah.
Yeah. She's, you know, so I like the fact that they stayed true to her. They didn't try to give her some white vanilla milquetoast looking mom. They actually gave her, you know, an Asian mother, which worked. And I thought, and I don't know the name of the actress. I've seen her in other things, but she was really nice. And I really liked their little interactions.
It was really believable.
It was extremely believable. I mean, your kid is at, she's at work. She's saving up money for law school. Her car doesn't start. She calls mom. Mom's at work, but mom takes off to come and give her a jump to get her back on the road.
And there's some foreshadowing about dad there, that dad may be a very hard-ass character.
Well, and he's an attorney. So she's like, well, I didn't want to call dad because, you know.
Oh, my God, she's a Cosby kid.
Yeah. Mom, doctor, yeah, exactly. So, and then, of course, these men show up. And her mom tells her to go get in the car when she realizes the men mean trouble. And her mom warns her really quickly to get in the car, to get away. So her mom knew something was up.
She knew, yeah.
And then these guys point blank kill her. They shoot her mom 3 or 4 times, kill her. And then they seem to suddenly wake up to the fact that daughter is standing right there. Then these guys turn into the two worst shots you've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
They can't hit the car, the girl next to the car, 6 feet in front of them.
Well, you know, it's that whole... that force field that heroines have around them.
She then does what every smart woman does in that particular situation. She runs like hell.
Mm-hmm.
Good for her. Actually didn't have a problem with that. Runs like hell into the woods, trips over a log, hits her head, looks up, and the world gets fuzzy.
Well, didn't she get a little bit of a look of some wolf man thingy before she goes fuzzed out?
She heard something.
Oh, I thought she saw him.
No, I think she heard something. She saw him later. But she was all fuzzy. At that point in time, my daughter, my mini-me, looked up at the screen and said, did her contacts fall out?
And that's why that is my number one girl.
Yeah. So, you know, it sort of just goes downhill from that. The creature comes out in the woods. He rips the guys apart and leaves her standing there looking shattered and covered in blood. And her vision is still blurry. Okay, right up to that point, I'm invested.
And after that, it becomes a meh festival.
Oh, my God. I wanted to like her, but I could never see. I mean, first of all, Kat Chandler, whatever. I never saw. I mean, there was a very funny moment when we see flash forward 9 years. Now she's apparently a hard-ass detective. Not seeing it. She doesn't look like one.
Nope.
Has super dramatic makeup, super dramatic hair, gets out of her car.
And swagger.
And a swagger. Oh, yeah, she's got that whole little swagger going on. Goes to beat her boyfriend. I'm assuming that was her boyfriend, and I'm doing my air quotes over here. Next funniest moment in the entire show happens at this particular point. So here we are. We're not even 6 minutes into this show. The two best moments happen in those 6 minutes.
Yes. You want to tell that moment? Because her boyfriend is a stoner, and
yeah, he's pot. And he's like, well, she's like, oh, I don't care about the pot. Da, 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 da. He's like, well, I didn't think you were going to show up because you always blow me off. So he's already got himself another date. And she's looking at him like, okay, douche. So she holds up her badge list as security. You might want to check him. He's got marijuana on him.
That was funny because she waves her badge and then she rolls out.
And then she did. She just sort of swaggers back out. Funny, funny moment. But everything after that just didn't work for me. I didn't buy her as Kat Chandler.
Me neither. I didn't buy her as anything. It was like I was reading a script on television. Like I was watching the words roll by, and it was interior, police station, blah, 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 blah. yada, 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 yada.
It was so forced.
Yes, everything felt forced. And then there were all the stock characters, the Latina partner, the hardest.
I'm not discrediting. The actress was beautiful.
I liked her, yeah.
But maturity level, I mean, I keep looking at Kristen Crook's character and going, she's 17, it's Lana Lang, she's still in Smallville playing dress up. And then you've got this lady who is a woman.
Yes.
Looks like a woman. And I mean, okay, I'm going to be a little more, you know, generous and say 10 years older. But
there's a maturity difference.
A very huge maturity. And yes,
because I don't mind the age difference, but it's the maturity difference.
Yeah. And I know it was a little physical. I mean, maybe I am judging a book by its cover in this particular instance, because Kristen Crook was obviously trying.
That's the problem. You could see her trying. And not only that, but you could see the male lead trying. You were always aware that these people were actors playing roles. They even had the requisite black captain barking things. Like, don't tell me about dirty crime scenes because I'm eating.
And we had the fat, nerdy, dumpy...
best friend. Yes. Oh, my God.
We have a big conspiracy theory going on. Yeah, I like the fish face there. That was looking good.
And we have the escaped medical experiment. This show is like...
soldier.
Yes.
And then we have a ginormous, I mean, that fight scene on the platform in the subway, great fight scene.
Yes.
I'm not going to lie. It was a great fight scene. And I mean, I totally bought that she kicked the living crap out of these three guys. And then she gets shoved and lands on the tracks. Okay, well, that's bad enough. But dude, her vision goes all blurry. And my daughter goes, look, her contacts fell out again.
What is up with this chick? Is she like concussion central? And then she just lays there because now she needs saving. Again, I guess because it was in the script.
Okay, so then he shows up and he saves her. But her vision is blurry, right? She couldn't focus. She kind of sees the blurry shape. She knows it's him because she's already met him. She knows this. He disappears. So what does she do? She runs down the subway tunnel to chase him. This is not a broken down abandoned subway tunnel. This is a very active station where a train had just left. And anybody who lives in New York knows trains come in and out all the time.
Right. And if there was ever a situation where I wish the third rail would have come alive.
So she races down this tunnel. Again, her vision is so blurry. She could not see the people on the platform. But she races down a dark tunnel. TSTL, and at that point, Heather checked out of the episode.
And for those of you who don't know, that is Too Stupid to Live, and this show is too stupid to talk about any further, and we're out.
Okay. Vampire Diaries returns. It's season 4. We come back to find Elena transitioning to vampirism, and I'm going to say it, guys. I love the episode because it had a lot of the key things that I love about Vampire Diaries in it. And I was also horribly disappointed by the episode in the same exact breath.
Yes, ma'am.
In large part because a typical Vampire Diaries episode delivers twists, it delivers turns, it delivers oh my god moments, and I love that they just did that moment, and oh god, where are they going now?
Yes.
This episode spent so much time going, oh look, we had all of these big things that happened over here, let's... okay, we're done. Those guys are cleaned up. Okay, now we're going to go back to Elena, and she's transitioning. Okay, now we're over here, and we're going to do this. And then we have all this stuff coming up, and now we're going to blow up everybody in this John Jones moment, and we are just the beginning. What the fuck? And all of that aside, we knew Elena was going to transition to a vampire. This was not a shock. If you kill her, the show's over. She is the main pivot point for the show. So, yes, there was, of course, a no-brainer, so that was not a shock. What was a disappointment is the way in which she transitioned. She's in a cell. She has not drank blood all day because Stefan was feeding into her insane idea that maybe there could be a solution that Bonnie could save her.
Yes, Stefan and Bonnie, despite all the warnings against it.
And the fact that Damon's looking at him going, dude, it's never happened. Just the basically, you know, there is no door number three option. You feed her, you die. We have been told this over and over and over again. This is not new to the canon.
Right, and on the flip side, Jeremy says to Bonnie, hi, how the frick are you going to go over to the other side and bring anybody back? Don't do this.
You've got to kill yourself.
Jeremy's like, do I need to lose both you heifers?
Jeremy also had the stupidest line in the episode when he looked at her and he said, I don't want you to become one of them. that I can't think of anything worse than you being one of them. Jeremy, I got something worse for you. How about her being dead and gone? Oh, wait, you still see dead people. Maybe that's not why it's not worse. Your sister is going to haunt you for the rest of your life. Wouldn't that be fun during sex? Look up, there's Luna.
No. You're evil.
But I digress. Going back to the trailer.
Composure.
So we've been seeing Elena hearing everything, her sensor, you know, and she's overwhelmed by the sensory input. And all of this has been going on, but now it's getting closer, it's getting later. Rebecca is witnessing her decline because she's growing weaker and weaker, and if she doesn't feed soon, she will actually die.
And Rebecca's loving it.
Oh, Rebecca's totally enjoying it because she's like, my day just got a whole lot better. I get to watch you die twice. Because Rebecca is a biatch, but that's okay. I actually like the little biatch, even if she does whine way too much for my taste. But, again, I digress. Because she witnesses the lovey-dovey moment between Stefan and Elena, you know, separated by the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have our moment of Stelena passion. Okay.
I will always come back to you.
I will always come back to you. I chose you. You were the one I chose. And she's actually trying to comfort Stefan to make him feel better and understand that, by the way, Stefan, you know, when that bitch across the way there killed me, I was on that bridge because I was coming back to you. So all your fault, have my guilt. Anyway.
Oh, don't forget that Elena now remembers all of the beautiful things
We will get there.
Okay.
We're going to get there. Thank you. Now, the problem is then Stefan and Rebecca work together to kill one of the guards.
Yes.
And Stefan rips out this guy's throat and throws him to the right. Now, Elena's cell is 6 inches over from his. He doesn't manage to actually get the, he's got the guy in his, he's got a hold of him. And instead of laying him down and dropping him down next to the, so he's right there at the bars for her, he throws him down. So he's just out of reach so that Elena has to work for it.
Yes.
And she manages to get a head and a shoulder through the bars, which Nina Dobrev must be like 2 inches wide.
Yes.
And that's amazing. But dude, once your head and your shoulder is out, just slither your happy butt right through this.
You're out.
Your head and your shoulders are out. You're out. Anybody who's given birth, the head, the shoulders, the body, the baby is out. It was like they were doing this whole, we're going to give birth to a new Elena here. And I really feel like that was the parallel they were going for. So she puts her fingers in the blood and we get 2 fingers of blood in her mouth. And then we have the little orgasm face. And now she's a vampire. Okay. Yippee freaking kaye. Matt is 25 feet outside that barn with Damon, with his throat already ripped open because Damon damn near already bit him because Damon is pissed that Matt's even alive. And they had this beautiful opportunity.
Yes.
To have Matt make it in that barn, go to that cell, and have Elena feed off him. A, it's what they did in the books, not with a barn. Screw the barn. But Matt is the one who helped Elena transition in the books. It would have given Matt purpose. Elena saved his life. Now he was able to save hers. It might have gotten him a certain amount of, you know, credit with Damon. Maybe not, but, you know, maybe. And we would have bookended this friendship between Matt and Elena that has existed for the entirety of the series.
Absolutely. When you told me that that's what happened in the book, and I realized the symbolism of Elena sacrificing her life for Matt's, and then Matt, in turn, giving Elena a new life, the symbolism in that is genius and beautiful, and they could have had some angsty song by Lifehouse or something like that playing. Hey, Vampire Weekend, why not? We all would have been exceedingly and ridiculously happy.
The juxtaposition, too, that here's Matt, the human ex.
Right.
Give Elena something neither of the Salvators can give her.
And something that he feels guilty about because he wishes that he had died so Elena wouldn't have to die. And therefore, he's giving that back to her. The symmetry, like you said, the bookends. It was a genius moment. And instead, they did, hi, I'm going to toss you a fresh bodyguard. Boo!
Yeah, really. Big, thickin' boo right there. That right there is the moment that actually made me disappointed in the episode. And that didn't make me hate it because, again, it's Vampire Diaries. We had great Damon snark. We had the, again, what you were bringing up earlier, Elena finally remembering the things that Damon has taken away when he compelled her. We have her remembering his first declaration of love in the episode Rose, which was in season 2, which is, I believe, is episode 8, was also featured the first appearance of Elijah. Mm-hmm. And then we know that she's remembered their first meeting on the Wickery, around the Wickery Bridge.
She met Damon first, not Stefan.
She met Damon first, and he took that memory away because he didn't want anyone to know that the Salvatore was back in town. But we saw that in the season finale episode where he also told her all the things he wanted for her to have. Mm-hmm. And Damon never wanted her to become a vampire. As he confesses, he didn't understand it, why she wanted all the things that she did. But he finally did understand it, and he wanted her to have that life. He wanted her to grow up. He wanted her to have kids. He wanted her to have grandchildren and all of this because it's what she wanted. And now she never gets to have that.
Absolutely.
Because she is a vampire with all of a vampire's requisite bloodlust, needs, and heightened emotions. But there is a moment in that scene, too, at that car, because, of course, Damon is kicking Matt's ass. He wants to kill Matt.
Yeah,
and
he does.
And jumps Damon and makes him get off. And then she sends Matt away, and then she's looking at Damon. And she's like, why are you so angry with him? It was my choice. If you want to be angry with someone, you be angry with me.
Right.
And Damon doesn't answer her. But then when she points out that she does remember it, why didn't he ever tell her? He says, oh, because we all know about you and your choices.
Yes, he did.
And as he starts to turn away, and she starts to say something as he's starting to turn away, and he turns around, looks at her, and he goes, oh, and our first meeting, that wasn't the only thing you remembered.
Yes, he did.
Walks away. There is a scene that we haven't seen. There is something that happened between the two of them that he took away, and I'm wondering, in part, if they had sex at some point, and he took that memory from her so she would not feel guilty.
Maybe it. When they went to go get Jeremy.
Maybe.
Because maybe they were all in the motel and everything. Okay, let me tell you my favorite scene. Klaus, whom Heather and I, if there is anything the opposite of a door, we the opposite of a door, Klaus, okay? So, Klaus in Tyler's body finds out that Caroline has been taken by this Reverend character who we haven't mentioned yet, but he is basically the town's emergency plan for dealing with vampires. And he kicks in with a vengeance. He took all the vervain supplies from the Salvador basement.
Took off the tainted blood from the hospital. I referred to him and his men as the Expendables Vampire Diaries version.
Yes, that works for me. That's what they were. And so they've taken Caroline, and on the road,
and Rebecca,
whom we hate as well. So, well, not hate, well, okay, yeah, whatever. So they're on the road on the way to this farm, which houses the barn that Heather has told you about. And Klaus rolls in Tyler's body and puts an end to that mess. He comes in guns blazing, not literal guns. He saves Caroline and leaves Rebecca.
He's
like, yeah, I'm done with you. I'm taking my woman. So they run off and they get into the woods. And of course, being this knight in shining armor and her boyfriend, she is extremely turned on. So her and Tyler start getting it on in the woods, but of course it's Klaus, and he mistakenly calls her love, and she's like, pump your brakes, buddy. Did you just call me love? And he says, I don't know, did I? Which is such an asshole thing to say. She's like, Klaus? And of course it is Klaus, and now she's super pissed off, so she punches him in the snout, which is awesome. And since we're wrapping up, well, no, we won't go there yet, because wish I'd said that it's coming up and Heather's going to want to tell you that great line. But We will close out by telling you that's the best scene in the show for me. By the way, some really bad stuff happens with Bonnie, and Heather and I have complained
Bonnie
about the fact.
Bonnie is dead to me for a little while. Bonnie is dead to me as after this episode. I've had problems with the character for a while now, and I mean, she was one of my favorites on the show. So this has been a big, long, you know, sort of fall for me. Bonnie's dead to me for a little bit.
You heard it here first, folks. But Heather and I are not really that pleased with the way that Jeremy and Bonnie are being worked. They seem like set pieces to us. We'd like to see a bit more from them. And we'd like to see Bonnie stop being so reactionary. All she does is react. And folks, her reactions cause her to lose the most important person in her afterlife. And I'll leave it there. Despite what we've said and how we've said it, we actually enjoyed the episode.
So, I know. See, that's what I said. I loved the episode, but I was still profoundly disappointed because I thought there was ginormous missed opportunities. But I am happy My Vampire Diaries is back on television.
Score. And what we'd really like to talk about in a twist on our moment of silence is that CW did air the Whedon brothers, all three Whedon brothers, awesome web series, Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. This is genius, people. It is about a supervillain, not quite a supervillain yet, a burgeoning or aspiring supervillain who would like to get into the evil league of evil, led by the equine bad horse. And it is a genius piece of work here. It is funny to the point of passing out, and it has great music. These boys know how to write songs.
Well, you got Joss Whedon writing, you got his brothers writing with him, you got Nathan Fillion, you've got Neil Patrick Harris. What the hell is there not to love? Isn't Felicia Day in this too?
Day is the leading lady.
Yeah, I mean, it's just everything about Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. I mean, it was an independent project that they released on the web that went viral.
Yes.
It became huge, and the fact that it was aired on the CW, well, kudos to them. I know it's a little late to the party. And just as a random aside, because we're talking Joss Whedon.
Yes.
For those of you not really keeping up with the new pilot that he's doing for ABC called S.H.I.E.L.D.
Hello. We will be talking about that in depth.
Yes. Clark Gregg has been tapped to be in this. That would be Agent Phil Coulson.
Oh, really?
A prequel series. So I just want you to keep that on your little, you know.
We love our dead Agent Coulson.
His first name is Agent, his last name is Son of Cole. We do love him.
So, to kick off Wish I'd Said That, I'm going to give you two quotes from Dr. Horrible, both of them by Captain Hammer, as played by the lovely and delicious Nathan Fillion. The first quote is, "These," and he holds up his fist, "are not the hammer. The hammer is my penis." Secondly, Nathan Fillion sings the line because he's fallen in love with Felicia Day, and this is a whole new awakening for this blowhard, pain in the ass character. And he sings the following line: "This is so nice. I just might sleep with the same girl twice. They say it's better the second time. They say you get to do the weird stuff."
And it's so funny. I mean, I know I've seen it, but I could so see Nathan Fillion saying that. It flows.
What do you have for Wish I'd Said That Vampire Diaries edition?
For the Vampire Diaries? Well, we have Caroline after the big makeout session with what I think some fans are calling the Kyler character, the Klaus-possessed Tyler body, with going, "I need to go sanitize my mouth." There's Matt to Damon. Matt says, "You can't possibly hate me more than I hate myself." Damon, "Yes, I can." And then the quote I mentioned earlier, "We all know the way. You feed or you die. There is no door number 3. Damon gets the best lines, and you'll find as we do this, especially when I talk about Vampire Diaries, I'm almost always going to quote Damon, because very rarely do we get an episode where we don't get a great Damon snark.
That's so true. Well, should I do Supernatural? Do you want to do Arrow?
I want to do Arrow. I did do the one about the sister quote earlier when I was talking about Arrow, but my other favorite line, it comes at a party that they were having for welcoming Ollie back home. And here comes his buddy, Tommy Merlin. I actually really like Tommy Merlin. I hope they keep him around. He says, Tommy goes, "By my rough estimate, you have had no sex in 1,839 days. As your wingman, I highly recommend Carmen Golden." And Oliver's looking at these three or four women who are dancing up on a table, and he goes, "Which one is she?" Tommy says, "The one that looks like the chick from Twilight." Oliver goes, "What's Twilight?" Tommy, "You're so better off not knowing."
Supernatural, what's up, Tiger Mommy? The wonderful Lauren Tom, as I said, looks at Dean and Sam and scoffs at them at the prospect of her getting inked. And she says, "Like it's my first tattoo." And the minute she said it, I thought, Tiger Mommy, don't give a damn. And then Dean, at his incredulous best, says to Kevin, upon finding out where he hid the word of God on tablet form, he says, "You hid the word of God in a diaper bag?"
Nobody's going to look for it there.
Finally, Castiel in Purgatory says, I'm perfectly sane. But then 94% of psychotics think they're perfectly sane. So I guess we'd have to ask ourselves, what is sane?
You'd be asking the wrong people here to ask. I'm sorry.
Yes. And
I live in a world where fictional characters talk to me on a regular basis. So,
dude. And on that note, Heather and I have writing to do. We're going to go and let these voices in our heads take over. We're going to throw up two fingers to you, not in the British way, in the American way, and say peace.